Welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm your host, Ruth Amos. 1 Thessalonians 4 says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. In this podcast, I chat to all sorts of normal Christians, asking them just how they live their quiet lives and how they integrate their faith into their daily lives. I hope that by listening, you will be encouraged to go out and live your own quiet life to the glory of God. You can find the episode show notes, the Quiet Life blog, and other resources at ruthamos.com.au. That's ruthamos.com.au. Now let's get on with the show. Hello, I'm Ruth. It's so good to have you here with me. Today it is the 26th of September again. And I have just recorded the introduction to last week's episode, and now I'm recording the introduction to this week's episode. It's amazing what we can do with technology. Time travel, I think, is what it is. Anyway, I am recording early because as this goes out, I will be on holidays, and I will be enjoying my holidays, and then I will come back to you the week after this one. So reporting back on all the wonderful things I do through my holidays. I'm not sure what they are at this point. We will find out as it goes along. Anyway, it's episode 41, and today's guest is Matt, and Matt is a professor in the area of geodesy. I actually had to listen to the podcast again to make sure I was pronouncing that correctly. Geodesy is what it is. If you want to know what geodesy is, have a listen. He tells us clearly about it. We talk about the science of geodesy and geophysics, and about work-life balance, and about living your faith as an academic. And actually, in my blog this week, I talk about, yeah, that area, that balance thing, or whether it's possible and whether we can do it all. Answer here. The answer is no, we can't. And it's interesting to talk to an academic. I've come out of academia, and one of the reasons I came out was just because that the requirements, the work-life balance thing, I just found incredibly difficult. And Matt talks about how he prioritizes and how he makes that work for him. So I thought it was a really wonderful interview with Matt. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. No trigger warning for this one, I think. I hope not anyway. If it does trigger you, please let me know. I would love to chat with you about these things. And yes, I hope you really enjoy it, that you're uplifted and encouraged by this chat with Matt. And I will be back with you again next week. Today's guest is Professor Matt King, very important. We met at a prayer group at the university when I was working at the university, which I am no longer doing. And Matt's an outstanding researcher, and I found a bit on the UTAS Facebook, well, not Facebook, the UTAS website page, which is said that he works within the Surveying and Spatial Sciences group, which is part of a wider University of Tasmania group working on solid earth geophysics and geodesy.
Geodesy.
Geodesy, even. Geodesy.
Everyone always gets stuck on that one, Ruth.
I'm glad I'm not alone. And then it said, fast fact, Professor King has authored more than 80 peer-reviewed publications, including several articles in the leading scientific journals, Science and Nature and Nature Geoscience. And Science and Nature, I have to say, they're the really big ones that we all want to get into. So I'm very impressed by that. And he was awarded the Kavli Medal and Lecture, which was in 2015. A biennial award for excellence in science and engineering relevant to the environment or energy at the Royal Society in London. I actually remember that. I remember you taking off to London. For his research in field glaciology leading to the first reconciled estimate of ice sheet contribution to sea level. So we're going to get some explanation of that.
All right. It is a mouthful, isn't it? Right. Yes.
Yeah. So let's start there. What is geodesy?
So geodesy is the word that anytime I get interviewed, people get stuck on, and then it's a great way of actually talking about what I do because no one has ever heard the word. It's actually an old science. It's about the study of the shape of the Earth, the Earth's rotation, and its gravity field, and how those things change with time. And so the early geodesists were interested literally in the shape of the Earth. Is it round? Is it a squash ball? from north to south or from east to west, if you like.
So they weren't asking, is it flat?
Or no. I think we'd have moved well beyond that at that point.
Excellent.
But they were interested in working out the curvature of the Earth and hence what shape was. And then since then, we've moved into things like understanding how the Earth changes shape because of earthquakes or because of ice sheets melting and the Earth rebounding as that melts, the Earth's rotation and how that changes as water moves around the surface of the Earth or mass moves around inside the Earth, and the gravity field, is which changes because of all those things moving around on its surface as well. So that's geodesy. It's a measurement science,
right,
but it gives us insights into things that are going on in the surface, above the surface, under the surface of the Earth.
And you use a lot of satellites and things.
So I use a lot of global positioning system to measure very precisely sort of millimeter level displacements of the surface of the Earth or glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland that are moving and how they're moving and how they're changing over time. We use satellites to measure the Earth's gravity field and how that changes over time. And we make measurements broadly in our discipline out to the stars and quasars to look at the Earth's rotation and its wobble as well.
There you go. That sounds all amazing. And I'm sure there's a lot of interest in it in terms of climate change and things like that.
Yeah, so there's a huge amount. I mean, as soon as you start working on how Antarctica's changing and your ability to measure that, then it becomes really relevant to be able to start to say, well, we can actually very precisely determine how this vast ice sheet is changing over time and contributing to sea level. Same with Greenland. And we now know, largely thanks to geodetic efforts around the world, that Antarctica and Greenland are losing more mass than it's being replaced by snowfall, and so sea levels are rising partly because of that.
Yeah, which is not nice to know. But
and it's only going to get worse. The question is how much worse.
Okay, so where we normally start, and I'm going to go back to, is how did you become a Christian?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I grew up in a Christian family in northwest Tasmania, always went to church, and probably had some sort of faith from an early age. I can certainly remember as a young child sort of going off and, you know, getting the Bible and reading the Bible for myself before bedtime and praying. By about mid-teens, I was attending church because my friends were there. Sort of faith was sort of a very I don't know if I would have been able to talk in any way, shape or form about what my faith was. But I was still going to church. I was keen to go to youth group, all those sorts of things. And it wasn't really until second year uni when I was studying in Hobart at that stage in Tasmania here. And I was sent off to work for a year in industry. That was not because I was in trouble, but because I was that was the way the course worked. We spent a second year working in industry, and I was working in the remote west coast of Tasmania in a mining town, Zeehan, and working underground and on the surface doing mine surveying type work. And so that was a year where, as you know, as a now 19-year-old, I was thinking, well, or I think I was led to think, well, what do I actually believe? You know, I'm now, you know, no longer a child. Do I actually believe what my parents have taught me and what others had invested time in teaching me formally or informally? Or did I not? And through that year, I started reading books. I read the Bible. I'm sure I prayed. And it was over the course of that year that really the penny very slowly dropped, but most definitely dropped. But actually, yeah, I did actually believe really what this was saying, and this was something that I should invest my life in.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, so I've been just taking out of that the importance of having those youth groups and those social times, because if you left that much earlier, that might have not.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, youth groups are. I don't think the purpose of youth groups should primarily be keeping people in church. They primarily should be really about teaching the gospel and winning people to Christ. And I've got no doubt people were trying to do that. But for me, the benefit of youth group was just keeping me tagging along and giving me a structure of friends who were going on in the faith at various different paces, some of them a bit slowly like me and others more quickly. But when God moved in my heart to put faith in me as an adult, there was an ecosystem of people around me who could, nurture me, and I could be encouraging them and all sorts of things like that as well.
And had you been involved in Christian group here on campus as well, or?
A little bit. I'm naturally an introvert, I was very fringy. So certainly not in first year. First year, I had been part of one group for a bit at first year, but I was a bit uneasy around that, and because I hadn't worked out my own faith.
Yeah,
I think.
Sure.
And then after that, so after second year, I was standoffish a bit. I still hadn't worked out, my place, and, I wasn't entirely at ease with faith and life and how those things meshed, because I'd spent the last 7 years or something like that not, keeping faith, pretty much off to the side enjoying life to some extent. And so it took actually a long time to begin to unpick that. And I think part of that unease came from, I'd been through the Christian school system at least year 11 and 12. So I hadn't really been shown or worked out how to live or seen other people live as Christians in a non-Christian context. And so that took a long time to work through, actually.
So that's really partly what this podcast is about. Which leads me very nicely to my next question is, how do you live your faith in this non-Christian context?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing I had to get over was actually letting people know that I was a Christian. And when you've, sort of kept that from people or not really been a Christian for a while, that there's certain sort of awkwardness around that. Mm-hmm. And that took a bit of time, but ultimately it just takes some boldness to just go, well, let me invite you to something, and they go, huh? And then it becomes a bit clearer that something's going on. So I think removing the mystery from that you are a Christian, and I never had any substantial opposition in an academic environment to me being a Christian. People, I'm sure, thought that was odd. I caught whispers of people being aware that I was a Christian. So clearly people were talking about that in some way. But I also, tried quite a bit to open my lives to people. We'd try and have work colleagues and PhD colleagues over for meals and that sort of thing, just so they could see something more of my life than just work. I could have done more of that, and still could do more. But I think that's an important thing to break down and let people see that actually you live a genuine life. It's not just work, but actually work and faith are part of the same life, not two different lives that you live. And so it's good for them. It's good for my colleagues to come up to our place and see that we say grace, even though it's a bit awkward for them sometimes. I think it sort of blows their mind and, all sorts of interesting ways. But it's good for them to see that is how we live, that when they see me at work, it's only very much a small part of my life.
Yeah, for sure. Have you ever found yourself having deeper conversations with people here in this?
Yes. So over my career, I've had some really great deep conversations with people. I've taken people along to Christianity Explored type events.
Cool.
from work in the past. From time to time, there's a sort of interesting conversation of someone who's been to a Catholic school and has, sort of some baggage around that, but is still interested and engaged in those ideas. And so even just a couple of months ago, I was talking to one of the senior academic staff here about those type of issues in a sort of very surprising way. I didn't expect to walk into the tea room and have that conversation, but there it was before me. And I think that's one of the advantages of people knowing that you're a Christian and prepared to talk about it is that people then sometimes are prepared to talk about or ask questions or raise issues.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. So how do you balance your work life and your home life and your ministry life? Because I know you do some ministry at church as
well. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I'm an elder in my local church and lead a sort of home group Bible study as well. And my wife's busy because she's the women's ministry worker at our church as well. So that makes our lives sort of fairly ministry focused with three children in, you know, sort of senior primary school through to early high school.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say too, like, because I've come out of this culture at uni that maybe people aren't aware, but there's a lot of pressure here at uni to like to make this your entire life and to work 80-hour weeks and to do whatever. So this is why I'm asking the question.
And it is because I don't know anyone with a sort of a sort of ironic title of balanced academic life, which is used inside the university, which is meant to suggest that you're doing some teaching, you're doing some research, you're doing some service to the discipline. But the function of the result of all of that is that a balanced academic life is never balanced because no academic doing that role ever does 40 hours a week. They're all doing 50 or 60 hours, normally in the evenings, sometimes at the weekends. I've certainly been blessed and had the good opportunity to avoid that for much of my career because I've had largely a research-only focus. And so I've had great deal of flexibility, which has been great for ministry. If I needed to, you know, very occasionally meet with a pastor or something like that during the day, rather than night, I could do that. Or with a friend who wanted to talk about faith or something. I wouldn't do that a lot, but it did give me the flexibility to do that because I knew that I could make up with that at another time. But it also meant that there wasn't the deadline pressures of teaching and marking and assessments and exams and all those sorts of things. So I was able for a large part of my career to keep a lid on that, and I probably worked close to 40 hours a week or something like that, maybe a bit more, but not much more. Now that I'm in I have a teaching role, I have a substantial leadership and management role as well. I've tried to keep it broadly like that. Quite a few of the evenings I'll be doing a little bit of something, either it's checking emails or looking at a student's paper or something like that. So it does get into my evenings, but often my wife's also doing something or out or whatever, so sort of preserves family life a little bit. But I generally never work weekends, and I'd prefer for some parts of my career to be diminished than to just keep on going and sort of respond to the pressure of more and more and more, because I don't think that's sustainable long term, nor is it good for my family and my faith. So at the moment, I'd say that my personal research is taking a hit, but that's okay because family and being involved in church and ministry is more important.
So it's really about priorities.
Yeah, that's right. And you can get sucked into thinking you've got the right priorities, then you actually take a stock take of it on your life and you realise, hang on a minute, I'm actually making a lot of compromises in the things that I think actually should be the priorities. And that's something I have to really watch on, you know. I think we're all subject to not being present with our families because there's stuff going on at work that we're thinking about or we're on our phone. That's something I definitely struggle with, and I need to make sure, even though I don't work at weekends formally, that I'm not informally working at weekends well.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I definitely need to grow in as well. Yeah.
Cool. I've got a question here. I don't know whether it'll be easy to answer, but what do you like best about your job?
I like and I've always been blessed to work with people who are great, people who are keen to do their job, you know, not let the team down, make sure things happen, and are fun to be with. You know, that they like stopping for coffee and talking as well and having a joke and, you know, a lot of social interaction outside of work as well. And so I bring that into the sense of teamwork. So whether it's collaborations with people on research or working with people in leadership teams, I've always enjoyed working, in those relationships. And even though I'm an introvert, I could take, you know, that's actually the highlight, actually, I think, in being able to work with really good people to solve important problems or to present a solution that works really well for something, for teaching or someone's career. And that's the thing that I think gives me the greatest joy.
Yeah.
Probably the second thing that I think motivates me as a Christian, because I work in that broad area of climate science, sea level, ice sheets, those sorts of things. I am mindful of the climate change will hit the poorest of the world disproportionately. They'll have the least capacity to adapt. They'll have and they'll have the disproportionate higher impacts of climate change in the first place. And so if you're thinking sea level, you're thinking about the Pacific Islands, the Solomon Islands, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You're thinking about Bangladesh and the Bangladesh Delta, you know, tens of millions of people there who don't really have a great capacity to adapt like those of us in the West. So it's really important they get the best information they possibly can, that they and their governments, so that they can adapt, because in general they haven't actually driven any of the climate change we're seeing. So so there's that second aspect as well, that I enjoy.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, I think, because a lot of times if you're a person of faith and you think, how can I best serve the world, you sort of think, well, I need to go to those places and I need to, you know, whatever, build houses or serve them, you know, Mother Teresa and do the thing. But you're using the gifts that God's given you in a completely, you know, beautiful white office in a lovely Western country with good money. And yet, yeah, what you can do is serve these people in a way that someone on the ground can't actually serve them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And and it's good to know that. It is good to know that. And of course, a non-Christian can do that just as well. Oh, but for sure. But I certainly come at it with a I think certainly as a Christian scientist, I'm compelled to think about my neighbour, whether that my neighbour is in the Solomon Islands or Papua New Guinea or not so far away in Bangladesh. Mm. And if I don't do that, then there's something missing in my thinking. Mm. And so it is important. And it's good to be able to, you know, the academic life, as you know, Ruth, can be competitive sometimes. And so academics can lose track of the end goal isn't me getting the first or the best paper out. The end goal in this regard is actually getting the best information in the hands of the people who need to get that information, so that good and wise decisions can hopefully be made, and suffering can be diminished or reduced and not exacerbated. And so I think that being reminded of that sort of the love your neighbour angle to Jesus's teaching is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So when do you feel close to God?
This is a great question. So I think there's one regular thing, and then there's a time in my past where I think, oh, that was a sort of striking moment. So I'll talk about the second one first. So just over 20 years ago, I had the privilege of spending 5 months in Antarctica. I haven't been back since, but it was really tremendous time because we walked around the hills and got to sit and watch icebergs on the horizon and beautiful white snow petrels surfing the breeze and flying around in helicopters for 40 hours doing work and seeing parts of creation that are effectively untouched by human hands. And it was strikingly beautiful.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. And the scriptures talk about, you know, the heavens declaring the glory of God. Mm. There's the part in Romans we're talking about that, you know, that God has revealed himself through creation and, you know, leaves us without excuse. But both of those things, you know, in my mind, you know, this does speak to me a little bit. In a profound way of God's greatness and his glory, you know, especially when you see something that's not modified by human hands in an obvious way. It's quite striking. But I mean, the more and substantial thing is really just getting down into God's word and, you know, reading through. I'm reading through Colossians at the moment, and you know that you know, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. You know, that type of when you read those things, and I've read that passage many times over, but each time it strikes me that, you know, what we have in Jesus, with the revelation of Jesus, is just so compelling.
Yeah.
That we can actually see something of the invisible God as we look at Jesus and his character and what he's like.
Mm.
And so I think that to me is closeness. I enjoy being with Christian friends and gathering together and having fun, and you know, there's something about that fellowship that also.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, God's word is really the heart of it. Yeah.
Are you a regular quiet time person?
I attempt to be a regular quiet time person. I'm a imperfect quiet time person, but before work, before I come to work every day, that's when I intend to do it. But that's something, you know, discipline on that area would be good. No, I need to work on as well. Yeah,
didn't mean to put you under the thumb then.
No. Oh no, but aren't we all? And there's very few people who can finish their life saying, "Well, 7 days a week for all of my life, I did quiet times." You know?
No, absolutely.
Yeah. So we're all imperfect, needing to grow in that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. But devotion to that is a good thing to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Gives God the chance to speak into.
That's
your
right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Exactly.
So, what's one thing about God or Christianity that you wish everyone knew?
So I think that I would love for non-Christians actually to be aware that Christians are not generally offended by their questions.
Mm.
You know, often non-Christians might say, "Oh, look, I mean, I don't mean to offend you, but you know, what about suffering in the world?" and the case is that many thinking Christians have actually put a load more time into thinking about those questions from a Christian viewpoint than the non-Christian, and so would love to actually answer, or at least have a stab at answering some of those questions. You know, show that we don't have it all, but we've actually got the beginnings of something, or we've got, when we can point to Jesus, something very, very clear. Mm. And so I think that's what I'd love for people to know, is that Christians shouldn't be afraid of questions. We should be thinking about things and working on our own faith and thinking. Mm. But I'd love for non-Christians to know that they actually can come and ask us stuff. Mm. And they'll probably get a well thought through response that might surprise them.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I remember somebody saying one of the curly questions, and I can't remember which one it is, but I thought there are libraries full of books that have, you know, from a Christian point of view, have struggled with this question. Whole libraries, and yet, you know.
That's right. Yeah, for 2,000 years now, some of the best minds in the world have been thinking about these big questions with the education of their scriptures. And, there's very little surprising left to be done in terms of questions you can ask a Christian.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else you would like to share with us today?
No, I think I've actually run out of my – I didn't have a pre-prepared script, so I don't think there's anything else, Ruth, no. But it's really been great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing with
us. No worries.
There's a challenge for us all. Let's start asking some questions, thinking a bit more about our Christian faith, and be prepared to answer questions from people who give them to us. It's an important thing for us all, I think. Next week's interview is with Annette Young. She's an author and a homeschooler. We discuss writing a bit because I love writing. I try not to get carried away. And we discuss why she chose to homeschool her 4 boys. I want to especially thank Catherine Joy from Joy Music House for the music, and a big thank you to Matt Dobson for the transcription. And I just want to remind you, if this means something to you, if this podcast has helped you out at all, please feel free to share it with a friend or leave me a review on iTunes, because that will help other people to find this podcast. And I will chat to you next week.